happy or content. What a good life really means, and we hear a lot about happiness, how to find it, how to measure it, how to optimize our lives around it. But many people, when you ask them what they really want, don't say happiness. They want to say contentment. So what's the difference? Is one different than the other? Is one better than the other? Have we misunderstood what either of them really means? And of course, it's time for Philosophical Currents, and our friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota, he's going to help us sort through that. And Jack, it's a pleasure to have you on what will be your last appearance in 2025 on Main Street.
I am happy to be here. I am happy that 2025 is over, although I am not content with getting older. So,
yes, there you are. And it's always careful what you wish for, Jack. You just don't
exactly
know.
Right.
All right, let's get our bearings here, Jack. When philosophers talk about happiness and contentment, are they talking about the same thing, or are those two things fundamentally different ideas?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there because there are a lot of assumptions that we make, not only about the definition of those two things, but of the context and the background. So, for example, most people think of happiness and contentment as emotions, and I think contentment probably is. When people think about emotions, they often think of themselves as distinct from reasons, as distinct from justifications, that you can't argue yourself into being happy, for example. You can't be persuaded to be content. And I think in that instance, contentment has more of a connection to argument than happiness is. But let's take a step back for a second. And the tradition has messed around with the definition of happiness in a variety of ways, and lots of people consider it a form of pleasure. And so the early hedonists defined happiness or pleasure as the absence of pain. But what's the ultimate absence of pain? Death. So they decided that death was the perfect happiness, and people started killing themselves. So they reversed the definition. And now pain is the opposite of pleasure. And therefore, you know, death is the opposite of happiness. And now people don't want to do it. Definition solved. But the idea behind that is that happiness is a feeling, it's a sensation, it's an intuition, it's, as we would say now, chemicals reacting in the brain in a certain way, dopamine, serotonin, these sorts of things. But Aristotle comes along and says, happiness is not a feeling, it's a doing. And I think we've talked about this before in the show, that the idea is happiness is a pursuit of, he says, the function of human life, but we can be more general, the pursuit of the things that we think are valuable, the pursuit of the things that make us better, more virtuous, more capable people, as opposed to other things. And again, the examples that I would have used in our discussion are training for athletic event. When people are running 20 miles, they aren't necessarily feeling pleasure, but they may be happy. And when people are suffering through the first few months of having a newborn and they're exhausted and the mother's body is tired, they may not be experiencing pleasure, but they're experiencing happiness. So happiness is something larger, and it's a procedure, and it's a lifelong thing. Contentment is a response to the context that you find yourself in. And contentment says, is this good enough right now? Am I relaxed? Have I achieved what I want? Do I need anything else? No, I don't. And so contentment is a moral judgment about how much effort you need to put in and how much is enough, in a way that happiness is not, because happiness is a much larger thing. Interestingly, you don't need to be happy to be content, and you don't need to be content to be happy.
And that's what I wanted to ask you, Jack. I look back at the roller coaster we call 2025. Great times, tough times, everything in between. And you remove all of that, and there were times that I was very happy, but I'm not sure whether I was content. As I look back on my life, I feel that I'm content, but not always happy. So you say that you can be happy without being content. You can be content without being happy. Where does that fit for us? You must have to have some happiness in your life to be content.
again, it depends on how we're using the terms, but also the circumstances in which you're answering the question. So, for example, if I am the victim of a flood and I have spent all day trudging through the rain and the mud and I find an empty barn with bales of hay and I get into the hay the hay loft and I'm warm and I'm dry and I can sleep safely, you could say at that moment that you are content. But I doubt you would say you are happy. And this actually leads to a very interesting discussion in economics, because one of the ways that economists try to evaluate whether people, the quality of life of people, is their satisfaction. How satisfied are they at any one given moment? The problem with this is, and this is an example that the economist, Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen puts forth. He was a guest on the show, by the way, on Why, that if you are a mother in rural, poor India, and everyone needs all the calories that you can afford, you give the sugar to first your husband, who has to work, and then the kids, and then yourself. And the mothers often don't get sugar in their tea. So one day someone comes along and says, I'm going to give you a pound of sugar a week. And all of a sudden you have tea with sugar. Your satisfaction level has increased exponentially. But that's not a reliable indicator of whether you have a good life. You're poor, you're struggling, and your life is so precarious that a bag of sugar can make such a big difference. So satisfaction is relative in that sense. Contentment is relative in that sense. And I think you and I, right, we are in professions in which there is a clear model of what the elite is. You know, I could be teaching at Harvard. I could be teaching at Stanford. I could be teaching at the Sorbonne. You could be
at CBS.
At CBS, right? Okay. But I look at my 25 years at UND and say, I did good work. I raised a family. North Dakota was pretty good to me. Maybe on some level, there's part of me that might want to work at those institutions. But frankly, I'm content here. You know, I'm UND gives me what I need. And I'm content. It doesn't mean that if an opportunity didn't fall at my feet, I wouldn't take it, but I'm content. And if I retire from this job, I will be able to say that I had a job that I found fulfilling and worthwhile. I think the same can be said for you, as much as I know you, but yeah, you should speak for yourself. That's contentment. Imagine someone, two people, one person's unhappy and one person's content. Unhappy, one person is discontented. If you walk up to the person who's unhappy and you say, you should be happy because you have a beautiful child and you have a secure job and there are no earthquakes. We were talking about this before the recording. There are no earthquakes where you are. You can't make someone be happy. You can drug them up and give them euphoria, right? You can give them a high, but you can't make someone be happy. But if you walked up to someone and said, look, you have a healthy child, you have a good family, you have a reliable job, there are no earthquakes, you can exhale for a while and say, this is good enough. You can persuade someone to exhale in that way, whereas you can't persuade someone to change their fundamental values and their holistic sense of who they are and what they want and what's important to them. Happiness refers to that. Contentment refers to momentary, contextual, individual, special circumstances.
In thinking about this, Jack, I thought about two things. First, society, I think, puts enormous pressure on us. Our culture puts enormous pressure on us to be happy. Every ad that we see, the end game is for us, it seems, to feel happy. From your perspective, from a philosophical perspective, is that expectation healthy, realistic?
I want to use a sort of strange example here for a second, because I want to talk about a kid's cereal.
Okay.
We have taught, you know, certainly our generation has taught our kids, don't use drugs. Drugs are bad. They're addicted, blah, 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 right? The putting aside the legalization of marijuana last, you know, 5-7 years, the central message of life from the 1970s and 80s was abstain from drugs. You know, as Nancy Reagan said, just say no. There was, and probably still is, a children's cereal called Trix. And Trix used to advertise with a bunny. And the bunny's sole desire was to get the cereal. And the bunny would trick and lie and manipulate and was desperate to get the cereal because eating the cereal would make them euphoric. Their raison d'etre would be fulfilled. And there was actually, Cocoa Puffs had another version of that, the bird that went cuckoo for Cocoa
Puffs. Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly right. How can we tell our children not to want drugs when the model of a good children's cereal is addiction? And is addiction to such an extent, the desire to get high, a sugar high maybe, but still high.
And happy, perhaps.
And happy, to such an extent that you will sacrifice every moral virtue and everyone you love to do this. We tell our society to be happy, but we teach them to want things that make them unhappy or that undermine that. Another example, just, you know, we're having conversations about Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein, and we are very, very clear that sexual activity and sexual desire for 14 and 15 year olds is illegal and immoral. But every 14 and 15 year old on television is wearing, you know, the young women are wearing midriffs, Disney and Nickelodeon. They don't have ugly kids. They have attractive kids. And we're not supposed to encourage age gap relationships, but every movie we see, you know, a 25 year old woman with a 45 year old man. Those of us who were old enough to remember who Bob Dole was, when Bob Dole was running for president, he was in a commercial for Pepsi where they showed a Britney Spears dance where she's, you know, again, scantily clad, midriff, all that kind of stuff. And they cut to him, who's about 84 in the video, and he's holding a pencil in his hand because his hand doesn't work because he's a veteran. And he says, "Wow." And pardon the graphic image for some of our listeners, the pencil is erect. The pencil is a phallic symbol. The pencil is a sign of how he is supposed to feel about this young woman. So every single message we get as to the things we're supposed to want are things that our culture also tells us we're supposed to feel guilty for wanting, or we're supposed to deny ourselves. We, and here I'm speaking specifically about America, but every country has its problems. We have constructed a society in which we are operating on desire and acting on denial. And that can't be a society that promotes happiness. And it doesn't promote happiness in the satisfaction sense, in the emotional sense, but it also doesn't promote happiness in the sense that we're not going to be healthy, we're not going to be virtuous, we're not going to have strong senses of ourself. So I think the society tells us, to answer your question that you asked 4.5 hours ago, tells us that if we are not happy, we are not good people, but provides only the mechanisms by which we can desire things we don't or can't have, and thereby undermines that happiness and does not help us achieve what we should achieve.
Undermines contentment, perhaps, as well. Jack, let me reintroduce you to our listeners. Jack Russell Weinstein is my guest. We visit monthly. Our little segment here is called Philosophical Currents, but Jack is also the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, a monthly program aired right here on Prairie Public. Jack, I read in The Atlantic now a couple of weeks ago a story by Arthur C. Brooks, and essentially he was saying, I think, that some thinkers argue that peace and happiness come not from elevating ourselves, from wanting more, from being perhaps realizing how small we are in the grand scheme of things, finding relief and even comfort recognizes our own smallness. And that seems to be able to bring contentment rather than despair. I don't have enough. I need more. I'll never get there. Oh my gosh. No. You're a speck on a speck.
There, I think, is an element of truth to that, in the sense that we have to be realistic about the world we live in and who we are and what we have. And I should not expect, as a philosophy professor, to own a Ferrari or even to cure cancer, right? I like to joke that I want to write a book that is so good it wins the non-existent Nobel Prize in philosophy, right? I have to know that's a joke, right? I have to understand what the limitations are. But at the heart of that argument is a cultural and, frankly, very Christian notion that desire is destructive, and that what we need to be is ascetic, minimalist, and know our place. And I think that that's problematic, because part of what makes human beings so miraculous, so wonderful, so challenging, is the constant pushing to open up the world. Where would we be? I was just in Italy getting my daughter, who was on a semester abroad at college, and we're bringing her home. And where would we be if Michelangelo had not made the David? Where would we be if he had not painted the Sistine Chapel? If someone said to him, Michelangelo, you just paint the pretty boys that you look at every day. Don't overstrive. And we constantly have conversations. As a philosophy professor, my students often say, well, this question can never be answered. You know, you're asking me a question that will never have an answer. And I always say the same thing. I say, we don't know that it will never be answered. Just like we have to say, we don't have the cure for cancer yet, as opposed to we don't have the cure, cancer can't be cured. There's no reason not to say in philosophy, we can't, I don't know, prove the existence of God yet, or we can't come up with a definitive human ethic that is respectful of animals. We haven't done it yet, but maybe we can. And so to what extent the human animal is designed, is constructed to be the discoverer, the explorer, the creator, the inventor, that our essence is to make things larger than ourselves. In my experience, and of course, I think this varies greatly, but in my experience, if I were not part of that project, I couldn't be happy. And that's one of the reasons why I love teaching so much, because forget the books that I write or anything else, I have important impact on many, certainly not all, students' lives. And every year I get what I call the five-year email. And the five-year email is the student who said, you may not remember me, I was in your class, it was so important to me, and I wanted to thank you, and I think about it all the time, and blah, 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 blah. And often it comes from students that I wouldn't possibly have imagined that I would have had that effect. I had a student who was a rugby coach, I think it was rugby, and he talked about how he figured out how to be a rugby coach by remembering the things we talked about in class, right? If you take away that desire to be larger, if you take away that desire to be more, if you say human beings should recognize that we are specks and we should be happy with our place in the world, what that does is deny the fact that all of us have the potential of increasing the world, healing the world, putting love in the world, even if that may only involve our neighbor, a friend. I'm sure many of your listeners will have this experience too. There's at least one person on our block with a snowblower. And so some days we walk out of the house to shovel, and they have snowblown the entire block, right? And it's just such a nice thing. It's such a thoughtful gift to just do the whole block. That person isn't curing cancer, but they're making us bigger and larger, and they're giving.
They're making our world, as small as it is, still a better place.
That's right. And so that's my reaction to that sort of celebratory of smallness.
So, Jack, we have a couple minutes left, and I want to talk to you about community, actually, because we've talked about it before. And of course, we live in rural North Dakota. People, I think, value steadiness, routine, and community. And do you think contentment then is more closely tied to those values than happiness is? And do we really have it better than we think right here?
Community is incredibly important. Community is incredibly important for virtually all human interaction, whether it's having shoes, right? Because it takes 500 people to get the leather, bring the leather, make the threads and sew it all together and blah, blah, right? So human beings, always community oriented. But human beings also need companionship. They need love. They need the ability to judge what's right and what's wrong. And they have to see other people in that way. But also that community just makes the day-to-day life nicer. My best friend Gail is currently visiting. She lives in New York. She's a retired New York State trooper. We met, I was a sophomore in high school. She was a freshman in high school. We met in French class and we have been best friends ever since. I was the maid of honor at her wedding. She was the man of honor at my wedding. And we've always lived very far away from each other, except for a very short period of time. And she's here and I'm just having a blast. I'm in a better mood. I struggle, as many of our listeners know, with depression. And I know that I would be less depressed if Gail lived near here instead of 1,500 miles away and $700 plane tickets away, right? My daughter is here on break and I don't even have to talk to her, just be in the same room with her and I'm happy. So community is incredibly important, and we can feel that way about our friends. We can feel that way about our kids. We can feel that way we had a neighbor for years who tended a really beautiful garden. And sometimes I just stood on the porch and took pleasure in watching her garden, right? Because it was so interesting. Do we have it better than we think we do? I think in most instances, there are a lot of things that we probably ought to be more appreciative of. I think the risk in that approach is to say, you should be appreciative of what you have, so you shouldn't expect or feel entitled to other things. So for example, you feel safe in your town of 300 people. But just because you feel safe in your town of 300 people doesn't mean you aren't entitled to a better school system or entitled to maybe a more robust medical clinic, more diverse peoples to bring an interesting new restaurant, or having your kids connect to other parts of the world, right? What it means to live fulfilled in our world, and that's a word we haven't talked about yet. What it means to live fulfilled in a world is a robust notion that involves the pursuit of happiness, not necessarily happiness, but the pursuit of happiness and contentment. I think the question becomes, when we are content, what can we do for other people? Because then we have the room to help others be content and to create more fulfilling human experience for everyone involved.
That's Jack Russell Weinstein. He and I visit every month here on Prairie Public. Our segment's called Philosophical Currents. And Jack, of course, is also the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, a monthly show right here on Prairie Public, a program that features philosophical discussions with a wide variety of really cool guests. Jack, thanks for joining us, Jack, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you. Here is hoping that 2026 is the single best year in human history. Don't face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when